You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Do you know where the food on your plate comes from when you sit down at a restaurant? Even when it's a farm-to-table kind of place? And even when it's not? Is the farm's name on the menu, or is farm-to-table just another buzzword? Americans now spend nearly 60% of their food dollars eating out, to the tune of $1.5 trillion, meaning that restaurants shape not just what we eat, but how food is grown, who gets paid, and what values we support. And yet, not every chef is living up to the promise. Some menus hint at rustic fields and small farms while quietly sourcing from massive distributors. You're listening to One Bite is Everything, the podcast where every dish starts a deeper conversation, and the food on your plate, even at a restaurant, is connected to the rest of the world in ways you're probably not considering. I'm your host, Dana DePrima, your tour guide on this journey through the intersections of the most delicious food, its production, and the layers of culture that swirl around it. Today on the show, we're diving into a crucial question. What does it take to truly live and cook your values in a food system that is stacked against us? To help us answer that, we're joined by Chef Molly Levine of Westerly Canteen. From the legacy of Chez Panisse to her own mobile kitchen in a 1970s Airstream trailer that's nestled in the Hudson Valley, Molly is reimagining what a restaurant can be, rooted in relationships, transparency, and a deep respect for the land. In this episode, you will learn three key things. One, how sourcing directly from small farms challenges traditional restaurant economics. Two, why farm-to-table has lost its meaning and what to look for instead. And three, what happens when chefs and farmers actually work in tandem, not just in marketing copy. And we'll uncover something unexpected. Why even people with the means to choose better food often don't, and what that says about the future of our food system. If you're ready to question what's on your plate and who put it there, then come along for us on this really enlightening episode of One Bite is Everything.
I think it was ultimately community that drew me to becoming a chef. I always have had a very deep connection to gathering around the table, dinner culture, and when we traveled as a family, where we ate was so much a part of that. But then I went to college and I studied English Lit, and I was in Nashville, Tennessee. I went to Vanderbilt, and I didn't personally connect with the culture of the school I was at. And so I just found myself seeking a lot. And what always made me feel most connected were dinner parties, cooking for people, gathering around a table. And then I ended up working in coffee shops and cafes just as side jobs while I wrote my thesis, and really sort of felt this resonant, like, these are my people. And I hadn't really felt that maybe ever before in that way. So much of it, I think, is just the really hard work and the way that you're constantly having to connect with people, both as a team, but also obviously your guests. So when I graduated college, I had a sort of interest in farming just because I felt very allergic to sitting at a desk and I wanted to be out in the world. And I ended up juggling whether I wanted to go have an experience working outside on a piece of land or working in a restaurant. And I ended up in a restaurant. I always say it was by accident, although obviously I put things into motion that made that happen. And I really just became addicted to the work and the creativity of it and the people who it drew in. And after a series of life events and a couple of years in Nashville after college, I ended up in the Bay Area visiting a friend and very fortunately landed a job at Chez Panisse.
Chez Panisse, founded by Alice Waters in 1971, revolutionized the American dining scene by focusing on the use of locally grown seasonal ingredients. In an era where fast food and mass production dominated, Waters' commitment to quality and sustainability challenged the status quo. The restaurant's menu is a celebration of the natural rhythms of agriculture with dishes that change daily based on what's available at nearby farms and markets. Waters has been a vocal advocate for small-scale sustainable farming, and Chez Panisse's deep-rooted relationships with local farmers and food producers reflect this philosophy. In fact, the restaurant works with over 100 small farms in Northern California, ensuring that only the freshest, most ethically produced ingredients make their way onto the plate. Chez Panisse isn't just a dining experience. It's a reminder that good food is deeply intertwined with the land and that how we source our ingredients can influence not only your health, but also the future of our food systems.
And that was sort of where I felt like a career gelled. It but was before that that it felt like it was these accidental steps of self-discovery as a young 22-year-old. And then working at Chez Panisse, I was like, this is my path. And it was really there that, you know, I was fortunate the restaurant that I worked in Nashville and the mentors that I had there were really in a way ahead of their time for that area of really pressing forward local sourcing and being super keyed into where the food was coming from. But very few places were doing that. And this was like 2010. And there was, you know, in other regions, maybe more of that being pushed forward. But in Nashville, Tennessee, it was definitely sort of a new phenomenon for people to be caring and paying attention. But from the very first restaurant I worked at, that was a part of how we connected to the food we were making. And then I worked at Chez Panisse, which obviously is, you know, that's what they stand for. And so it really gelled as less of just a work style and more of a whole lifestyle, belief system, way of connecting with a greater network of people. And it was really fortunate to get to work with some of the most incredible products maybe in the world. And that's sort of how you drink the Kool-Aid. But it also really opened my eyes up to how impactful the work that I was doing could become. You know, it wasn't just about feeding people who were wealthy enough to come to a restaurant necessarily, but it was also about the education of where this food comes from, how we can decrease the miles it travels, and really support this greater web of our food system by making sure small farmers have an outlet to sell their product to.
So if we could just go back for a second to your family. Can you paint me a picture of what it looked like at home around food?
Yeah, I mean, it was nothing fancy, but it was a really intentional part of each day. My mom was a stay-at-home mom, and each night we would have dinner together as a family when my dad came home. And it was almost always something made from scratch. And there was a lot of Einegarten recipes and simple roast chicken, grilled pork tenderloin, you know, simple food, but all of it felt really nourishing. And I think the experience and the intentionality of gathering around the table each evening and making sure we were connecting and pausing, it was about the food, but it was more about that experience of coming together. And, you know, we were fortunate to also go on family vacations and travel to places like Italy and Spain. And I just remember that being so much a part of everywhere we went, was like, where are we eating? And like, what are we experiencing in that way? Which I think now with social media, there's almost this competitive edge to travel of like making sure you check off every place. But at that point, you know, what there wasn't social media or that comparison. It was really about just the experience. And that was really formative for me of just having these eye-opening different flavors and experiences around food. But so much of it really, I think, was rooted in just the gathering around a table and making sure time was spent, and food provided that.
In Nashville, you mentioned that they were particularly tuned in, especially for the time, in terms of sourcing. Yeah. And I find in talking to restaurants all over especially the smaller local places, for example, upstate, they tell me that they have a challenge to source locally because of prices. And maybe that's not so much that the prices are high from local farms, but that the prices of like wholesale goods from, you know, Baldor or Sysco or wherever they're getting their food are so artificially low. And I'm just curious, like, how that happened in Nashville and the rub between like sourcing really well and that sort of allure of a lower price point, and will the customers really know?
I think you're touching on something that's also just like a core issue for me, and I could spend hours talking about it because I have since spent my entire career being so committed to local sourcing in a way that has sort of put me at odds with restaurant owners that I'm consulting for or opening their business for, or even sort of the diluted farm to table allure of places like the Hudson Valley that you mentioned, or I've operated a restaurant in the Hamptons and Martha's Vineyard, and all of these places are so dense with amazing access to farm local product. And because the price difference of what the farmers have to charge versus what a company like US Foods or Baldor or God forbid Sysco, you know, can afford to charge, it does sort of rig the system that even in these places of such dense agriculture richness, it's very rare that any of these restaurants are really sourcing largely, if not even partially, locally.
Large distributors like US Foods, Baldor, and Sysco, with their massive purchasing power, can negotiate lower prices from producers and squeeze farmers even further, creating a significant gap. They do this by leveraging their bargaining power to secure lower prices for products, often forcing farmers to accept less than what they need to cover costs. These companies also impose long payment terms, sometimes stretching to 90 days, and demand high volume, consistent supplies, which can push farmers into scaling up production unsustainably. Additionally, they charge excessive fees for transportation, packaging, and late deliveries, further reducing farmers' already slim margins. This market dominance limits farmers' options and forces them into unfavorable contracts, making it difficult for them to thrive or invest in sustainable practices. This discrepancy not only affects the livelihoods of farmers, but also impacts the quality of food that consumers have access to. The imbalance also perpetuates an economic system that favors bulk purchasing and profit over supporting local economies and sustainable food systems.
I mean, that has become a lot of my work mission and what I do with my project, Westerly Canteen.
Westerly Canteen isn't your typical restaurant. Molly has brought a no-frills seasonal approach to food where the menu is shaped by what's fresh and local. Everything comes from nearby farms, fishermen, and artisans, making each meal a true reflection of the land. The Airstream acts as both kitchen and dining area, creating a relaxed communal atmosphere that invites guests to come together over simple, thoughtfully prepared dishes. The canteen isn't open all the time. Events pop up at various spots, often in agricultural spaces, bringing locals together to enjoy good food and good company. It's not about grand decor or fancy dishes. It's about the connection to the food and the people who grow it. It is sustainability and seasonality at the heart of every plate, all while creating a genuine sense of community.
And what I've done at all of these places that I have been fortunate to be the chef of, even if it's just for while I'm there. But back in, you know, 2010, 2011, when I was in Nashville, I was there until the beginning of 2013. It's so wild to think of what the difference of what things cost then versus what they cost now. And the expectation of what people want to pay for food hasn't changed that much in that amount of time. But what product cost and what labor cost was different. And so it does make it even harder now than it was then. And you know, I don't want to paint like a false perception of what my experience was there, because it was still nowhere near what I now do. But it really was admirable for that time. There was certainly still product coming off a U.S. Foods truck into that restaurant. But there was also a real commitment to anything that could come from some of the places. Like, there was a goat cheese purveyor, I think it was called Noble Farms Creamery. And, you know, all of the cheese that we got for this one sandwich or this salad, like, came from there. And there was a, I don't remember the name of the farmer, but they, like, all of the lettuces for the restaurant came at least from that farm. It wasn't comprehensive, but it was a lot more than something else. And I think while unfortunately, that restaurant didn't survive. You know, they were open for 6 years and then eventually closed, which we can attribute that to anything, whether it was the rising cost of doing business. I can't say for sure. But at the time, I do think, and I continue to think, that the narrative of where these things were coming from was also part of its success, was that people had something to attach to and get excited about. And there was a personal story behind each dish. And that was really novel for the time in that region. I think it was a lot of why people really gravitated towards it. It also felt healthier. Like, all of the food was really bright and fresh. And so much of that, I think, can be attributed to where the product was coming from. But then I went to Chez Panisse and was like, oh, wow, what we were doing there was, you know, small peanuts compared to what's happening here. I think it's also really important to be realistic about what Chez Panisse was and is able to do, and how that isn't necessarily a fair metric to anyone else. You know, it's like these relationships with these farms have been established for 45 years. And so the cost of doing business is really different. The need for that restaurant to be as economically successful is different than like a new small business opening now. And I think that's where the economics of sourcing are so fraught. And you're right to make the comparison of like, there is a completely unrealistic expectation set by these big box companies that set price standards. I read recently or last year, Tyson Foods has set the industry standard for what beef should cost, and they haven't raised that price in like 45 or 50 years. And so when we think about the rising cost of literally anything, from housing to labor to water to grain to anything that goes into those inputs to make any form of farm survive, have gone up and up and up and up each year. And so it's no wonder that like the cost of things keeps going up. And ultimately, when you look at how much things really should cost, it makes it really hard for a restaurant to actually pay those prices and then not become some elite establishment that only can serve the 1%. And I think that's been sort of this chain that I've been trying to navigate pretty much my whole career since leaving Chez, is how do I really honor what I stand for and source as entirely locally as I can and not be cost prohibitive to everyone but the 1%. And it's really hard. And there are so many things that go into this, which I'm sure you know. Some of it is just that, you know, we're talking about politics and tariffs right now. The reason that our farm system can't really compete with a farm system in like Italy or France or Spain is that so much of their agriculture is held up by government support. But our farm system has never been held up in that way by government support, except for, you know, monocrops and big ag. And so if we want to actually support a small agricultural industry and then have restaurants actually source from those, there's no support in actually making any of those individual businesses able to stand on their own 2 feet. And for the restaurant to be able to afford the price of the farm product, the farm has to charge a product that they're not able to sustain. And it's actually a food chain of like who's being eaten, and someone is always suffering. I mean, this is a really depressing statement, but I remember chatting with a friend in California just comparing notes on operating our businesses. And we were saying how we want to pay our staff at least a living wage, not a minimum wage, a living wage. We want to source from our local farmers and pay them what they need to survive. And we want to make sure that we're still approachable to the community. And the reality is you cannot be all three, you know, or it's very hard. That's what my friend said. You can't be all three. And I've just been so committed to trying to be all three. And it is really hard. It works sometimes and not all the time. And I too am someone you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation. You're just here to like keep being positive because someone has to, because there has to be that consistency. And I have worked very hard to maintain that also. And there's these sort of swimming upstream feeling constantly that only seems to be getting like the water is rougher and colder and a little murkier. And it does really require a lot more education. I think so much of what makes it really hard to stick to your sourcing principles and charge appropriately is the lack of transparency behind where those numbers come from. You know, people come into the restaurant and they'll be like, oh my God, why is this entree $45? But as soon as they understand, like, okay, well, everyone on our staff is paid at least $22 an hour plus tips. And that's what the living wage is in Dutchess County where we operate. And on top of that, every vegetable, every piece of meat, every dairy item, all of our fruit is coming from this tri-corner region. And to do that, this is what this costs. And I do think that that transparency and honesty and education really makes a difference. And B is really having more of like a universal either commitment or transparency. I've started to hate the word farm to table because it just feels like it's this diluted, I want there to be another word. It's become such a buzzword. I mean, it's sort of like the way organic became diluted. Like, what does it really mean? What does it really stand for? At least there's a standard of what you do have to achieve to become certified. But with farm to table, it's just a word that people can easily smack on their menu. And it actually then dilutes what some of the rest of us are trying to do.
The term farm to table has become somewhat diluted due to overuse and misapplication in marketing, with many businesses adopting it without adhering to its original meaning or spirit. Initially, a movement to connect consumers with locally sourced seasonal produce directly from farmers, now it's often used as a buzzword by restaurants, food suppliers, and even large corporations that may only purchase a small percentage of their ingredients locally, while sourcing the bulk from industrial distributors. Some businesses claim to be farm-to-table while relying on large-scale farms that don't follow sustainable or ethical practices, undermining the true essence of supporting small sustainable farms. Restaurants get away with this because there's no real standardized definition or regulation for the term, allowing for broad interpretation. They may source a small percentage of ingredients locally, but still rely heavily on larger distributors for the bulk of their food. And consumers don't often have a clear way to verify sourcing. Since the term is used broadly and without much scrutiny, restaurants can exploit this ambiguity to make their menu appear more sustainable and appealing, even if their practices don't fully align with the values of true farm-to-table dining.
I won't name names of restaurants that do that, but there is a perception, especially in the Hudson Valley, of, okay, I'm going to this farm-to-table hub of where all of these restaurants are sourcing really well. And there's sort of a general assumption, and whether restaurants intentionally false advertise or just ride on this false assumption, then people believe that they're participating in supporting local agriculture or eating food that comes from that region. And an even more extreme example is, I remember when I was living on Martha's Vineyard, I became very close with a lot of the farmers there. They were a big part of my community of living there. And I remember talking to a few farmers. One of my friends, Jefferson, was raising chickens and poultry, and another friend was a vegetable farmer. And both of them would constantly regale me with stories of how they would be telling me this when they'd come to deliver product, like basically thanking me for continuing to source from them, because there were all of these restaurants on the island that would say, you know, Good Farm Chicken or North Tabor Greens or whatever it was. And they had ordered from that farm maybe once the whole season. And so like, okay, well, we did order so we can put it on. But these farmers were telling me that they were certainly not providing a volume to these restaurants that would indicate that that was always their product on the menu. And so there's really, yeah, there's a problem with education. There's a problem with transparency. And then, yeah, the general cost of what things really do cost. And I don't know the true solution for that. I think a lot of it is, unfortunately, something we're not going to get anytime soon, which is government support. You know, how can these farms have an infusion of capital so they can continue to operate the way that they need to, pay their people, get the supplies they need, but maintain a price that then ultimately, like, they are where it starts. And then it's either sent to a grocery store or a restaurant or a farmer's market. And those prices that get sold to those three different entities are always different. You know, they're going to make the most money selling direct to consumer. They're going to make the least money selling to a grocery store or a restaurant. But it's important to have all of those revenue streams and also have that product exist in all of those places. But if the farm can't actually afford to wholesale or to, you know, get their product to those different places, how are we actually going to get more people eating local food? And how are we going to have restaurants really participating in putting their money where their mouth is? And it feels hard to solve because in a way it's no one's fault. You know, the farms need to do what they have to do to survive. The restaurants need to do what they have to do to survive. And a lot of times the consumers also need to do what they have to do to survive. So ultimately some other support needs to exist.
As I listen to you, I mean, your ethos, your values didn't happen overnight. It really feels very rich and very full, and like you have a really good understanding of all the different parts of the chain from really firsthand experience. And I think that people hear a lot of, oh, Shea Panisse and oh, Alice Waters. And I would love for you to explain and describe for us what it's like to be a part of her kitchen, what it means, what you learn, how you learn it. Like, what is it like in there?
Yeah, I was there for almost 4 years. I chose to stay. I really enjoyed my time there. You know, while Alice created this universe, she wasn't there a lot when I was there, which is totally understandable. Her priorities these days are the edible schoolyard and giving talks. And I was there from 2013 through 2016. So this is almost 10 years ago now, which is wild. But yeah, so much of her efforts during that time were really to be on the road giving talks. And so my experience wasn't necessarily that I was working for Alice Waters. My experience was that I was working in her world. And so much of what made that world special were the people in it. You know, I shared at the beginning of our conversation that what really drew me to restaurants was the community. And when I ended up at Shea, I really found what felt like my people. It was people who were committed to not just working in a restaurant, but they were there because they cared about all of the things we're talking about. And that was really the buy-in to working there, was, do you care about not just restaurant culture and the adrenaline of working on a line during dinner service or, you know, mastering butchery and nerding out on cuts of meat, but do you care about beauty? Do you care about where your food is coming from? Do you care about being a conversation of a bigger narrative? And everyone who I worked with was really passionate about all of those things. And so it transcended the whole experience of working there. Also, it felt like my education. You know, I was a pretty young cook when I started there. I had worked at another restaurant for about 2 years. But before that, I had just been a college student, you know, not in the food world. And while I sing a lot of praises about my experience in Nashville, I came to Shea and quickly realized, like, wow, I really don't know a lot. I don't have a real foundation. I did not go to culinary school. And Shea is a teaching kitchen in a lot of ways. And I learned whole animal butchery there. I learned really about caring for product and how to properly handle it and store it and cook with it in very simple ways. You know, there's a reason Alice's books are called The Art of Simple Food. The food there is so simple. It really relies on the quality of the product coming in more than the technique. And so you learn to taste and do very little to manipulate such high quality. And so it requires a restraint that I think is missing from a lot of kitchens. You know, so many kitchens, especially of 20 years ago, were about sort of like tricks and technique and big flavor. And what has really, I think, made Shea stand apart and where it built a foundation for me was in its simplicity and just starting with really good product and doing very little to mess with it. And so the restraint that that really requires, I think, is in itself admirable and very different from a lot of kitchens. It also is a very different kitchen culture. I sometimes say, like, I've had a very unique career. I've never gone and worked for a classic male chef culture. And I feel very lucky to have never really been in that environment. Some of it was intentional and some of it was lucky accident, but so much of Shea's world, because it was built on a foundation of like, Alice had never worked in a restaurant, really, you know, like she came and just wanted to throw these beautiful dinner parties for her friends after living in France, was really the foundation of Shea. And even though by the time I got there, you know, years and years later, and there had been much more experienced chefs hired to run both the cafe and the restaurant, and many generations of those chefs, I think there still remained sort of this unique aversion to classic restaurant culture. And while there was certainly a professionalism to it all, there also was a degree of care that, again, I've not really experienced working for one of those other chefs that you read about, but yeah, there was a feminine energy to the whole space that I think is really unique. And I have tried to carry that with me to other places that I've managed.
I have an impossible question. I want to hear from you about the farmers or farmer who are really important to you and who you have a relationship with. And I want to hear about those people, their farms, and what's special to you.
Yeah, it is very hard to whittle it down to one because my menu writing process starts with making many phone calls or checking many email lists. So I'm constantly in communication with different growers in the region, and I get a list from all of these different people. And then each week I compile a menu based entirely off of what is available. So, you know, I work with a farm called Harlem Valley Homestead. I work with a farm called Maitri. I work with Stonewood in Millbrook. I work with a really small producer called Thistle Pass in Millerton. And then I work with some slightly bigger growers that are still considered small farms in Hudson, like MX Morningstar and Common Hands Farm. Those are probably the ones that I'm reaching for the most because they grow diversified vegetables. And I basically look at all of those lists and say, okay, like Maitri has their first asparagus this week and Harlem Valley has Little Gems and MX Morningstar has beets. And then with all of those different items, I construct a menu. And then there's, you know, the dairy farms and meat purveyors. Work a lot with Chase Home Farm in Pine Plains, Herondale in Ancrumdale. Harlem Valley Homestead does also raise meat. And then a farm called North Plain up in Great Barrington. And so we'll reach out to them and see what their availability list. And that's sort of where our proteins come in to supplement all those beautiful vegetables from the other farms.
I'm curious about the world of food and chefs kind of on one side and farmers on another. There is a tremendous work ethic and attention to detail and doing things that are important when no one's watching kind of ethos.
Other than operating at different hours of the day, it's a very similar work ethic. A lot of it is redundant, task-driven work. A lot of it is unglamorous. A lot of it is hard on your body. And a lot of it doesn't pay well. And so there is sort of, I think, a connection of you have to really love the work and the people you're doing it with to sustain it. And those two industries have that in common, you know, no doubt. And I think it's a shame sometimes that there's not as much of an actual community connection between farmers and chefs. I think it's shifting. And I think in certain regions, like the ones I've chosen to put myself in, it's easier because there's proximity. But in so many places like New York City or being in any major city, you're inherently somewhat geographically removed from where your food is coming from. And you can still be committed to local sourcing by, I would still consider local sourcing in New York City, sourcing from the Hudson Valley, because that's the closest of where your food comes from. It's very disconnected because you have to get in a car and drive 2.5-3 hours to interact with where that food actually is grown. And so I think culturally it's harder for cooks and farmers to be really in community with each other when so many cooks exist in a city and so many farmers exist in rural places. And I think it's really important to find ways to bring those communities together because they do have a lot in common. Their work is also inherently integrated, whether they realize it or not, but there is often a geographical divide.
Yeah. I talk to a lot of chefs who are, you know, prowling the farmer's market at 7:30 a.m. while farmers are setting up and going, what's this? What are you making? You know, and so they're connecting on sort of an urban turf where they have a little bit of a common space.
And the same goes really even for the Bay Area, you know, where I would argue that the connection of how consumers eat and interact with their farmers is even more transcendent into the general public than it might be in New York and on the East Coast. But still, a lot of those farms like that are selling at the Berkeley Farmers Market, they're still coming from 2-3 hours away to set up their product. You know, I think because you're in California, there's a little bit of this false perception that like it's right next door, but it is still a similar experience of you have to choose to really go outside of those city spaces to really interact with the farms itself. Farmers markets are amazing that they bring that product and those people and that experience into city spaces, but it would be interesting to sort of see the reverse happen a little bit too.
In case I didn't cover something that you really were hoping to talk about, is there something that's on your mind that you'd like to share? I would love to hear it.
Yeah, I think the one thing that I've been thinking about, which it's kind of a negative statement, and I want to maintain a sense of some positivity, but I think it's important to discuss the challenges of changing behaviors. And I think that is something that, again, some of the other themes we discussed of, you know, sort of having this universal buy-in and this support and also education is all really important in changing that. But when we moved to the region we live in now, there was a meat farm that had been started a few years before we arrived, and it was admittedly very well funded and supported by a couple with a lot of resources, and they really did everything, you know, technically right as far as their practices and their commitment to the regenerative nature of the landscape and treating their livestock well and supporting their farmers. And they closed soon after we moved there, and we became, you know, friendly with them. And they've also very generously shared access to some of their land, and we store our Airstream there. They're great community members and are very involved in food access in the region. And we were asking, why did you choose to close the farm operation? And ultimately, they said they really just weren't able to make it financially sound, despite all of the resources they put in. You know, one could argue that putting that many resources in makes it hard to make it financially sound. But one thing that really stuck with me that they shared was, you know, they have all these friends with a lot of access to money who can afford to spend more on food. And it was those people, even their dear friends, whose buying habits were the hardest to change. And while peak COVID, so many people turned to their local farms and farmers markets to buy local and support, it wasn't sustained. You know, after a while, people really do rely on comfort, easy access, and
convenience. And even people who can afford to spend more on, say, meat or produce don't necessarily. And I think that there is an opportunity to really, again, try and provide more education and outreach so that some of those behaviors can more sustainably be shifted or shift. Because I think that's been the most discouraging realization of all, is that even when there is access, it doesn't actually translate to changed behavior. And that is where I think it's really exciting as a chef and a restaurant owner to participate in that. And I think that's where it would feel really uplifting if more chefs and more restaurants were actually supporting local agriculture. Because even if we can't necessarily have consumers change their buying patterns, they can by proxy. If they go and dine at this restaurant that is sourcing that way, then by proxy, they are participating in changing their buying patterns or in supporting these farms. So there really just does have to be sort of a collective shift. And, you know, how that happens, I'm not totally sure. I'm here just as a small potato doing my part. But I think that finding a way for more restaurants to actually source really locally is one way to make that shift. To speak to just convenience and sort of what I was sharing even about our own sourcing is like where we are in the Hudson Valley, everything is really spread out. You know, it is somewhat unreasonable to expect the common consumer to drive 30 minutes to pick up their yogurt and another 40 minutes to pick up their asparagus and then go this direction to pick up whatever else they need. And so it does feel like an exciting opportunity to be able to do that for them and package it really neatly in this delicious and beautiful presentation where they get to come and enjoy and gather and convene around a table. And they're supporting those things, whether they realize or intend to or not.
What if every time you dined out, your meal wasn't just delicious, but also a vote for the kind of food system you want to live in? After this conversation, it's clear words like local and farm to table aren't enough. We have to ask harder questions about sourcing, transparency, and who really benefits from the food on our plates. Because the truth is, change doesn't start in a policy paper or a warehouse. It starts in the kitchen with chefs like Molly Levine and in choices made one ingredient, one relationship, one bite at a time. So next time you're handed a menu, take a closer look. Ask where the food comes from. Support the places that support your farmers, not just in name, but in practice. If this episode sparked something in you, made you ask questions, or got your mouth watering, help us keep the conversation going. Rate One Bite Is Everything with 5 stars and leave a review on Apple or Spotify. Your words help others find the show and join the movement toward a more honest, more sustainable food culture. One Bite Is Everything is co-produced by Sonia Dillon, and our original music and sound design are by Russell Chapa. Special thanks to them for making every episode resonate far beyond the table. Until next time, remember, every bite is a choice. Let's make it count.